Okay, this is our Genesis class, session number 2. Let's do a little bit of review. So we talked about Genesis and Revelation being bookends of the Bible. We talked about Genesis, especially the first 11 chapters, and even more especially the first 4 chapters, being primarily a theological treatise and a polemic against the cosmology of the Babylonian and Sumerian world. We talked a little bit about Genesis 1 through 4 as being a statement of the nature of God, or creating what we would consider the Christian worldview. We talked about my definition, which was critiqued by one of you as, like, where'd that come from? And I admitted, I told you up front that this is just mine for what it's worth. All right, and then we talked a little bit about the nature of evil and even the nature of the Big Bang, and there are some questions. So before we actually jump into the text, that's what we're going to do next. We're going to go into the text, Genesis 1 and 2. So any questions before we get into the text?
Ben has a question.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't been using my outline. There's all this good stuff I haven't been used. Okay. I should go over some of this stuff.
Go back to
all right. All right. The short outline of Genesis would be this. Chapter 1 through 11, primeval history. Chapter 12 through 50, the patriarchs. This is a very, very clear division in Genesis between the first 11 chapters and then chapter 12 through 50. So Genesis 1 through 11 covers all history up until roughly 1900 BC. And the next 39 chapters cover 4 generations from Abraham to Joseph. Okay? Now, to me, the heart of Genesis is part 2, it's not part 1. Because Genesis part 2 is the story of how God is going to solve the problem. It's the opening chapter in God solving the problem. So Genesis 1 through 11 is describing the problem. It's describing God and the problem. But it's prehistory. In other words, you can't date the flood. You can't date the Tower of Babel. You can't even date creation or the birth of Adam and Eve. So I'm not saying they're ahistorical, which means not historical at all, but I'm saying they're also not historical in the common sense of history. If you can't put a date to it, then it's really not history by almost any definition. I was in a debate, not a real debate, but a discussion, we'll say, with a Hindu guy. I had said something like this in a question answer. And I said that Jesus is real and Krishna is a myth. And this Hindu guy was very, very offended by that. And he said, how could you say that? Is this so disrespectful? Well, I said, well, with Jesus, I know when he was born. I know where he was born. I know when he died. I know how he died. I know the name of his father, his mother, 3 of his siblings, number of his friends, and, you know, all that stuff. With Krishna, we know absolutely none of those things. And he said, with Krishna, Hindu figure. So I said, I challenge you to tell me where he was born and where he lived and when he lived. And the guy, he went away for about 2 weeks. He came back and he said, well, he lived somewhere between 2500 BC and 200 BC, somewhere in there, in this place. He named the town, but this place, he couldn't tell me where the town was. All right, it's like, okay. Thank you very much. Krishna is not a real, he's not an actual person. He's a myth. How did it get on that? Okay, I don't know why. All right. Now, the tendency for those who kind of do talk about Genesis is to talk about the first 3 chapters. I'm not even that interested in the first 3 chapters, honestly, except as a discussion of worldview. I'm really into chapter 12 through 50, because that's where God describes his plan to solve the problem. The focus of Genesis is on two people, God and Abraham. I'm going to argue that Abraham is the most important figure in the Old Testament. Not Moses, not David, Abraham. Just read the book of Romans. How much does he mention Moses? Now, I admit Hebrews mentioned Moses, but I would argue that the most important figure in the Old Testament is Abraham. We are a Mosaic religion. But I would say we're an Abrahamic religion. Okay, got it?
Tell us why.
Yes, that's what I'm going to do for the next couple of days. Okay, the next in my outline is the author of Genesis. Right, I talked about that a little bit. We know the tradition is that Moses wrote Genesis, but there's absolutely no evidence that he did, other than a tradition. And I would say clearly the author has a Mesopotamian point of view from the early 2nd millennium B.C. Okay? Good. All right. Yeah, I've got to catch up with my notes here. All right, good. I'm on page... good. I almost caught up. Yes, question? Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What do you think about the documentary hypothesis? Like the WJ?
All right, that's actually in the notes. I skipped that. Oh, okay. So the documentary hypothesis is that there are three or possibly four different sources of material, not just for Genesis, but for almost the entire New Testament. The Elohists, the Yahwists, the Deuteronomists, all this sort of stuff. I would say that there clearly are different sources and different perspectives in the Old Testament, and the documentary hypothesis is not utter nonsense. It is not utter nonsense. And yet they make claims which are unsupported by the data. So they'll basically say, for example, the story of say, Noah is somebody took a pair of scissors to four different documents and sort of stitched them to... that's nonsense. So there's a lot of stuff in the documentary hypothesis which is sheer speculation. But to just completely dismiss it as, you know, as attacks on biblical belief and stuff like that, that's going a little bit too far, actually. I mean, clearly there was a priestly and a clearly if you look at Chronicles compared to Kings, there's clearly some clash in perspective there. And to say that that's not even true is... well, that's also not true. I mean, clearly the writer of Chronicles had a different view in mind, a different purpose in mind. I believe they're all inspired, and a lot of the claims of the documentary process are just nonsense and just crazy stuff. And many of the perpetrators of the documentary hypothesis are atheists. I don't trust them very much. Because, all of us have assumptions, I admit that, but if your assumption is wrong, that's very likely to produce error. So, for example, if you assume that God does not exist as a presupposition to discussing the Old Testament, you're going to be wrong so many times it's almost going to be laughable. And that's what I had to say about the documentary hypothesis to some extent.
Are we going to talk about Noah?
Yeah, of course. We're not in Genesis 6 and 7 right now, but we will be eventually. Yeah, we'll talk about that. All right, so Genesis 1, 2 through 10. What is going on there? Again, this is principally, I believe, a polemic against a worldview of Mesopotamia in the early 2nd millennium B.C., the Babylonians and Sumerian worldview, as the Emlish, with that book there. Okay, got it? So what's going on here? Well, the primary thing going on in Genesis 1, 2 through 10 is God is creating order out of disorder. God is separating light from dark, day from night, sky, water, land, living, non-living, male, female, good, evil. So God is creating order out of disorder. Who created the disorder? Well, God did. But the work of creation is creating order out of disorder. Now, there's a thing called the second law of thermodynamics, which says naturally nature creates... No, definitely not. Disorder. So if there's all the... And there's all... The lowest possible entropy thing in the universe is a living human being. How do you explain that? Okay? So God is miraculously, supernaturally creating separation between light and darkness, good and evil, living and non-living, male and female. So God is creating order out of disorder and distinction where there was no distinction. The world wants to blur things. Certainly wants to blur male and female. Now, as far as I know, two X chromosomes, that's female. An X and a Y chromosome, that's male. As far as I know, now it is true, there are triple X and there's XXY, and there's that 0.02%. We need to be compassionate. That's, if you're one of those people, that's a tough place to be. Why would God allow there to exist XXY people? I mean, we could discuss that. But that's, you're right. Anyway, I'm going to stop on that. Okay. So what does God do? He starts naming things. He calls the light day. He calls the darkness night. In the ancient Near East, to name something was to declare power over that thing. All right? And so that's what God is doing. And that's why Genesis 1 has God separating these things and naming them. Now, is the order essential? Probably not to the writer, and maybe not even to God. I believe, though, basically the order, I'll talk about that, is essentially preserved. In science agrees essentially with the basic outline, but that's not the... All right, so what is God doing? All right, so what he's doing then is he's creating... First of all, he's creating something out of nothing first. Then he creates order out of chaos. Then he creates separations and distinctions, and he names things. That's it. That's Genesis 1. That's what God is doing. All right? You could get specific, but that's the outline of what he's doing there. Okay, got it? Okay. It says, the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now, I've heard that used as an argument that the Holy Spirit was involved here. That is really, really, really pushing it. I'd say that's pushing it so far that you should probably just not even say that. Basically what that's saying is God is over the waters. All right, the spiritual is in some sense superior to the physical. There's evening and morning the first day. Normally we'd say morning and evening, wouldn't we? It's interesting. It says evening and morning. But then again, the Jewish day begins when? In the evening, at sunset. Okay, there you go. So there's a lot of order created from a lot of chaos, right? And basically, as you go through Genesis, the amount of order is increasing, which goes against the second law of thermodynamics, as you know. Okay, got it? That's sort of what's going on there in Genesis 1. All right. And then last of all, what does God do? Well, he creates life. Life represents the ultimate amount of order. And then notice in verse 14, he says, let there be lights in the sky. The writer purposefully downplays the roles of the heavenly objects. Just lights in the sky. Again, this is a polemic against the Mesopotamians, who obviously worship the sun and the moon and the stars. And later on, when they figure out their planets, even they worship planets. All right? He calls them lights. In the greater light and the lesser light, right? The greater light being, what do we call it? The sun, the lesser light, the moon. Again, this is a polemic. And in this case, the lights serve They serve us. All right? And so we are the focus of Genesis, right? He's kind of, it's kind of like the apex of creation is us, right? So God creates us in His image, right? Genesis 1, 26 through 30. What a beautiful, beautiful statement. We are created in the image of God. So, but what does that mean? Does God have fingers?
Maybe.
Does God have genitalia? Is God male? That's a question.
The Bible is referred to as male, but is it female qualities?
Is God male?
No,
definitely not. How could the, you know, because male and female didn't even exist until He created them. God is not male. Well, Jesus in the human body was, because there's only two options. He's either male or female. Or he either has a Y chromosome or he doesn't, all right? And we could argue why God chose a Y chromosome, but in that context, in that culture, he had to be male. You know, he had to be, I mean... But anyway. So what does it mean that we are created in God's image? What does that mean? Anybody, any thoughts? Yeah.
I guess I think of our conscience.
Okay, the fact that we are conscious, that we are self-aware. All right? Are dogs self-aware?
No.
No.
I would say they're sentient, but they're not sapient.
Dogs don't say I. Dogs don't say you. Even if they could, they wouldn't know what they wouldn't understand. Okay, so we are self-aware. What else? We're moral beings. All right, good. What else? Yeah.
God has imbued various aspects of His qualities within us.
Right. We are creators. Mm-hmm. We are creators. Okay. What are some other qualities that makes us in God's image? And, you know, because we could talk about, you know, did God create Adam and Eve ex nihilo? In other words, there's Adam, there's Eve. Or did God take an evolved creature and put His image in? Honestly, I don't care. Who cares? Because one thing I know is the image of God could not evolve. That is absurdity. And to say that we're not made in God's image is to deny reality, in my opinion. Yeah.
We can love.
Okay, love, yeah. Love. Can dogs love? No. Do they have something that is love-like? Yeah, okay, absolutely. That loyalty and... You know, yeah, I mean, but no, they... Would a dog even literally sacrifice its life? No, dogs will literally give up their life. They will literally give up their life for their owner. They really will. That's why they're better than cats. That was a conversation over lunch, yeah. But. All right. So we're made in His image, but that has nothing to do with our physical appearance whatsoever. Whatsoever. We are self-aware. We are persons. We create things. We give and receive love. We have a spiritual nature. We are eternal. We have free will. We are demigods or semigods. Okay? Be careful using that language and be careful even the setting in which you say that, but the Bible actually uses that language in Psalm. Yeah.
Well, also it says, according to our image, let's make man.
Okay, we'll talk about the royal we. That's the next thing I'm going to do. That's in my notes, the very next thing. In fact, the very next slide.
The sons of God were actually...
Okay, let's make mankind in our image. Now, there are two... thoughts on that. There are two thoughts on that. One thought is God is using the royal we. So the king says we when he means I. All right, there's that theory. Or the other theory is sort of like God and the audience. It's sort of like the scene in Revelation. So he says we, he says he means I, but he's referencing the heavenly assembly, if you will. And which it is, I don't know. But again, to use that as an argument for Trinity is, that's a very, put it this way, nobody who read Genesis before Jesus came would have interpreted that as Trinity. So anyway, the two possibilities are the royal we, and that's why Elohim, God, that, you know, the plural, gods, either that or the angels are in attendance, so it's the royal court. And which it is, I don't think it matters. Do we need to know that? So the three possibilities, I eliminate number three. I mean, who am I to eliminate? It's none of my business, really, to tell you what to believe. But I certainly wouldn't use that as evidence of the Trinity. Or put it this way, it might be because of the Trinity, but as an argument to a Muslim or to a, you know, atheist about that, wow. Good luck with that one. Anyway.
What would a Muslim argue? Which one would they pick?
Oh, that's a great question. I would imagine they'd pick the first one. You'd have to ask a Muslim. All right, sorry about that. It's from Fresno, but I'm going to have to say, talk to you later. I'm going to guess almost certainly the first one, because in Islam, this idea of a heavenly court, I don't think that even works very well. You know, the jinn, I don't know. Anyway, good. And then Genesis 1:31. Okay, let's read Genesis 1:28 first. Genesis 1:28. Okay, so the apex, the epitome, the height of Genesis is the creation of human beings in God's image. That is the entire purpose of creation. The only reason the universe exists is so that we could exist in it. And then you get to Genesis 2, and he kind of explains that in a little bit more detail there. Genesis 1:28, where God says, God blessed them, and he said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. So basically, God's purpose in creating us is so that he could bless us. He's like a parent. And by the way, there's only one command that God ever gave humans that they actually obeyed, and that's Genesis 1:28. We actually did a pretty good job on that one. Be fruitful and multiply. We've been obeying that. Even the most worldly people is really great at fulfilling that command. All right, anyway, sorry for that little sarcasm there. And basically, God says, our job then is to subdue and rule the world. Therefore, we can do to it whatever we want, right? No. There are a lot of conservative right-wing Christians who take that point of view. That aren't, you know, because God's going to come back anyway, so let's just, you know, right? I believe that we are stewards of this world, and that the Christian is naturally an environmentalist, right? If God put us in charge of something, then our job is to care for it, not to abuse it. So although, you know, environmentalism may not be the first, second, third, or even fifth or sixth priority of Christians, that environmentalism should be a priority of all Christians, and that Genesis 1 is a clear statement about that, that we are stewards of, which means, yes, we should reap benefits and blessings from that creation, no doubt, but we also are responsible to take care of it. In 1 Corinthians 3, I think, God says, those who have been given a charge must prove faithful. And I believe that applies here. Is it in my notes? I don't see it, but okay, great. All right. So, Genesis 1:31, he says, it was very good. Not just good, very good. This is unique to the Christian worldview. That creation is entirely good. And you have to admit, if you look around the world, it seems to throw that out the window really quick.
Yeah.
You read a newspaper, and 97% of it is bad news. But at the end of Genesis 1, you don't know why that would be, do you? You have no idea. But then you get Genesis 2. But by the time you get to Genesis 3, okay, I get it now. I get it. So we have to read the whole thing. It's all very good. Do you agree with that? Are you comfortable with the statement that everything God created is good? Okay, Genesis 2, 1 through 3. All right, Genesis 2. Let's read Genesis 2, 1 through 3. See how far we get there. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished his work that he'd been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Okay, now he's making a theological point, but God does not rest, not literally. All right. God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. All right, so God is not resting in the human sense of resting, but is resting from his work of creation. So the job is done, and then God says, okay, world, now sort of do your thing. All right? By the way, in Hebrews 4, 8 through 11 says, we as Christians do not have a Sabbath rest. Our Sabbath rest lies in the future. That doesn't mean we cannot observe a Sabbath if we choose to, but in Hebrews 4, 8 through 11, it says, make every effort. It doesn't, you know, our Sabbath rest lies in the future. All right. Now, the Genesis and creation, Hebrews 4, 8 through 11. All right. I'm not saying that those who take a Sabbath are doing something bad. But our Sabbath rest, the only one we have, is lying in the future. All right, so let's talk about the whole creation thing and all the whole Genesis and what about, you know, young earth creationism and all that. So these are some theories about, you know, how to interpret Genesis. All right, and there's a lot of young earth creationism out there. It's all over the place. And it's, you kind of cringe when you hear people talking about it because it kind of makes Christianity look dumb. But you have to admit, if you just simply read Genesis 1 and knew nothing else, you tend to go there. I mean, it does say the evening, morning, the first day, then evening, morning, the second day. So you have to admit that the young earth interpretation is, in a sense, the obvious one of Genesis. But then you have to ask yourself, right, but what is the Genesis writer even doing? What's he doing? Is he giving us a scientific treatise? Or is he writing a polemic against Babylonian and Sumerian theology? Which is he doing there? Right, and it's the second one is what he's doing. But anyway, there's the young earth. There's two kinds of young earth theories. One is this. The earth is young, and science agrees with this. In other words, basically they're saying the earth is young. In other words, the universe itself has only existed for a few thousand years, and that statement is supported by scientific evidence. This is garbage. That is garbage. It's the majority view of evangelicals. And it's utter nonsense. I'm sorry. It is not true. And anybody who says it's true doesn't make it true. It's like saying Trump won the election. Sorry.
He likes to go there.
Shouldn't have done that, but I did. It's on the recording. All right, but here's a second young earth view. I want you to consider this young earth view, and I want you to not laugh at it, because to me it's not crazy. It's that the earth is young because God created it within appearance and age. In other words, God could do whatever he wants. You know, when Jesus made fish, you know, it appeared to be how old? I don't know. It's this big. So how old is that fish? I don't know. When he made the wine, it was already, you know, fermented and aged. In fact, it was awesome wine, which means it's aged probably at least for a few months. And John the Baptist said that God could create, out of these stones, he could create sons of Abraham. If God wanted to make the earth to appear old, could he do that?
Yeah.
If he wanted to put dinosaur bones in the ground, I don't know why he'd put dinosaur bones. I have trouble imagining really why he would put dinosaur bones in the ground. But if he wanted to put dinosaur fossils in the ground, could he do that? Sure. Now, if you see a star, let's say this is a galaxy a billion light years away, just for the sake of discussion. So you're looking at a galaxy a billion light years away through your telescope. The light that's hitting your telescope, how long ago did it leave that galaxy, presumably? I'll give you a hint, 1 billion light years away.
About a billion years ago.
So how old is that galaxy? Well, it appears to be at least a billion years old. Therefore, that it appears that it it's young and it appears young. Nonsense! All right, but could God not only create the universe, but create the light already in path from that, you know, as if it... But if that's true, does that galaxy really actually exist or not? I mean, it certainly... So that it creates funny problems. For me, it creates all kinds of problems. This young Earth theory is wrong. I don't care what you say. I'm sorry. I apologize to you, but I can't help it. It's not true. I'm sorry. No amount of manipulating the data says that dinosaurs were hanging out with human beings. That's just, come on, give me a break. You know, I'm sorry. All right. Yeah. Now, could God in His wisdom and power, for a reason not known to us, created the earth in 6 literal days to appear the way it actually appears? Yeah, I have no problem with that. Theologically, I have no problem with that. Okay. So I say young earthers should stop saying this first thing. Stop it, please. First of all, you're wrong, and you're making Christianity look idiotic. So stop that. Second one, go for it. Great. But then just stick to number 2. So burn those stupid books that you write claiming that, you know, anyway. All right, there's the gap theory. I don't care about that. The day-age theory. I'm kind of like, I'm a day-age theorist, but a lot of my fellow Christians who are kind of a framework, all right, so I'm a day-age theorist. In other words, to me, God's saying, Genesis is saying, first God did this, then He did this, then He did this, and although the order may not be exactly reproduced, to me, there is at least some historical content in those days. So I'm a day-age theorist. It's like Jacoby. He's not. You know Jacoby, right, Doug? He's a framework guy. That's cool. I don't care. But he's a framework guy. He wrote his book. It was published a couple years ago.
Can you elaborate on that, the framework theory?
Yeah. All right. And there we go. Next slide.
Oh. Perfect.
Check it out. So the framework theory would say, according to the framework theory, there is absolutely no historical content in Genesis 1 at all. And most framework theorists also say there's no historical content in Genesis 2 or 3. I'm very uncomfortable with that personally. So I tend to go for day age partly because I don't like what the framework theory does with Genesis 2 and 3. Not that you have to do with Genesis 2 to 3 what most framework theorists do, but, you know, I just tend to take the more conservative view I just always do. Anyway, so basically day 1 is light's created, day 2 sky is created, day 3 land is created, day 4 luminaries in the sky, day 5 birds and fish in the sky, and day 6 land, animals, and man. So it's kind of like, it's like either da, 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 and da, da, da. And it's just sort of creating categories of what God did. The order is irrelevant. All right, and it is true that framework theorists would point out there's a couple of details in those 6 days that it's hard to rationalize with what we appear to know. For example, I think it seems to have life like in the air before. There's a couple things in there. It's like, you know what? I don't care. I just don't care. I really don't care. So I'll present the theories, and I don't care. All right, so going back, you're this person. That's cool with me. I don't care. You're this person. That's cool. I don't care. You're this person. That's cool. I don't care. This means that God's not real. All right, that's bogus. There's two bogus ones. I won't worry about gap theory. There's two really bogus ideas up here that are totally out of reality. They're not true. And that's this one, and it's also that one. By the way, Genesis 1 is a myth. It's a true myth.
C.S. Lewis.
The flood is also a myth, but it's a true myth. And you could even say the Jesus God-man story is also a myth, but it's a true one. Because a myth is a simplified story to explain God. That's what a myth is. But almost all myths are mythical when we say myth in English, we mean just not true. You know, it's just a fable. But really, that's not the definition of a myth. Not really. A myth is a simplified story told to explain the nature of reality. And myths can have no actual true content, or could have a lot. And so, I think I'm going to say that later on in one of my things. All right. Now, a quick summary of Genesis 1. First, God preexisted. Then God created the universe. Then God created the earth. Then God created life. And God created people. That's about right. I mean, that this is what science tells me. This is what Genesis 1 tells me. So that's why I'm a day-age guy. All right? But if you're a framework person, great. That's awesome. A little bit more detail. The earth is already created. It's spinning. There's night and day. Water covers the earth. There's a very, very thick atmosphere, so thick you can't even see the heavenly objects. The earth cools, land appears, life appears first in the water, then on the earth. And then eventually photosynthetic life actually evolves the atmosphere to the point you can actually see the sun and moon and star. Because there's day and night. By the way, the length of a day on Venus is almost exactly 24 hours, which is an interesting coincidence. But how often do you see the sun if you're on the surface of Venus?
You never see it.
Never, ever. So they have night and day, but there's no heavenly objects. So now that's a bit ad hoc. I admit it. That's a bit of an ad hoc defense of the day-age theory. But that's my defense of the day-age theory, that on the fourth day, it's true. At that point, the sun, moon, and stars appeared in the heavens. Okay. And then finally, heavenly objects appear on that fourth day. And more advanced forms of life exist. And finally, humans come along. As a scientist, I'm comfortable with all that. Now, again, I don't think Genesis 1 is a scientific treatise, but it just so happens that kind of the general outline, that works pretty well, actually. Is it a myth? Yes, it's a true myth. It's a simplified story given to explain the gods, or in this case, the one God, to common people. Genesis 1 is a mixture of historical facts and religious truth based on those facts. Okay? So, is it literal or is it metaphor?
Yes.
That's my final conclusion. Now, you don't have to agree with me on that. I really don't care. I do care what you think about Genesis 1 in what it tells us about God. I care about that a lot. But, you know, whether you agree with me of that last statement, Genesis 1 is a mixture of historical facts and religious truth based on those facts. Whether you agree with me on that, if you just say it's just historical facts and end there, like most young earth creationists do, amen. Just shake hands. Just don't make trouble at church, all right? Don't go after those. We actually put on a debate a few years ago. A debate was on different ideas about creation. So we had a deistic evolutionist, a theistic evolutionist, and then a young earth creationist guy. And the young earth creationist, he tried to attack us all and show how we're not even godly. It's like, dude, give it a rest. We just try to have a discussion here. Come on, give it a rest. But that's what young earth creationists do. I've met one that doesn't. They're just out to prove that you're not believing the Bible. Anyway, so that's what happened there. By the way, I lost that debate. The deistic evolutionist won the debate because his argument was the simplest to defend. So lost that debate, but that's okay. I don't care. Okay, we have other creation myths. If you're going to quote me to say that Genesis 1 is a myth, if you're going to quote me, just do me a favor, just don't even quote me at all. But if you're going to quote me, make sure you explain it, please, because you're going to get me in big trouble. All right, a myth is a simplified story given to explain God to common people. Exactly. What's the purpose of it? To Hebrews. Now, did they have? Does Genesis 1 mention dinosaurs? Does anything? Did they have a word dinosaur? What about microscopic? What about bacteria? Are bacteria mentioned? You know, the fact that bacteria is the first form of life. First of all, how could they have microscopic life if they don't even have a microscope? Give me a break. As if that's something that God even would have done. All right, so we do have other creation myths, but the difference is these myths are myths in the sense of the normal word, which is like utter nonsense. But they're not total nonsense, honestly. They're attempts to explain to people the nature of reality. And although the details are utter nonsense, the things they're saying aren't completely nonsense. Or at least try to. In other words, listen to the Babylonian myth, the Egyptian myth, and ask yourself, what are they really trying to say? All right? And anyway, so we've got these different myths. The Babylonian myth, the primeval swamp, Marduk kills Tiamat, the blood, and it mixes with the mud, humans come out. The Egyptian creation myth. Let me see. This is Marduk killing Tiamat in the process, the blood, and you see the humans. And that's the Babylonian creation myth. The Egyptian creation myth, that's almost kind of obscene, so I'll just move on. There's the Iroquois creation myth where Enigorio and Enigohata battling, Rona, it's all these other. I mean, we got all these other creation myths which have all these creatures and people killing each other and all this sort of stuff. And then we have the Bible, which says God created order out of disorder. He created humans. And, you know, so a true myth. Okay, got it? I'm not going to go into the whole day-age thing anymore. I'm tired. I'm done with that. All right. Now we're talking about Adam. All right. What am I doing here? Flood. Okay. Yeah, all right. So there's too much science. There's too much science in Old Testament. I'm going to just flash through this stuff. I'll talk about Adam as a type of Jesus later. I'm going to skip that for now. Talk about the flood briefly. Now, young earth creationists typically have the flood. They try to make the flood say a lot more than it actually says, that's for sure. And they'll say this one flood that created all the geologic layers and, you know, the flood create. You know, if you hike the Grand Canyon, see the Grand Canyon was created in this one flood event that happened, you know, 5,500 years ago. You hike the Grand Canyon, you go, seriously, you actually believe that? You actually believe that? You know, if that were true, then how do you explain the fact that, you know, mammals are up here, dinosaurs are down there? Do you ever see a mammal below a dinosaur, et cetera? You know, trilobites, they're farther down. You got trilobites, then you have dinosaurs, then you have people. So the whole fossil record says that this, the stuff that young earth creationists do with the flood, it's a joke. All right, but the flood is another true myth. In the flood, the bounds established by creation overstepped, and chaos and death ensue. In other words, I believe the flood is also a true myth because it tells us about human beings and it tells us about God. And the principal purpose of having the flood even in the Bible is not to tell us a historical story. The Bible's history starts with Abraham. I'm not saying the flood didn't happen. I believe the flood happened. You know why I believe the flood happened? Because Jesus believed the flood happened. All right, and I personally believe the flood was a universal flood. Yeah. I don't think it covered Mount Everest. Personally, I don't think it covered Mount Everest, but I think it was a worldwide event that was a judgment for sin. All right, I believe that. Okay. There are flood stories in all of these ancient cultures. Yes. In fact, virtually every ancient culture that is truly ancient has a flood story. How do we explain this? In fact, there are three myths that are common to almost all cultures. Creation myth, flood myth, and God-man myth. Now, the Bible has a creation myth, a flood myth, and a God-man myth. It has the true creation myth, the true flood myth, and the true God-man myth. And, you know, people, human-created religions have untrue ones. So there's reason to think that this flood actually happened, because how could Aztecs, Greeks, Babylonians, Sumerians, Celts, Hottentots, and all these myths have the flood being a judgment, a massive and worldwide effect, and yet every around the world there are scattered remnants that survive and repopulate the earth. Seems to be that's what actually happened. Decision to destroy mankind. Oh, this is Gilgamesh. I'm not going to need the Gilgamesh explanations. I'm not going to get into that. All right. And again, although the flood is a historical fact, it also is a foreshadow. And one of the amazing things about the Old Testament is God uses actual history to tell a story. That's crazy stuff. Now, human beings, what they do is they take a real event and use it to tell a story. But God, what God does is he uses an event to tell a story about something that hasn't happened yet. That's pretty amazing. So basically, if you read 2 Peter 3, it says the flood is a foreshadow of what God will do at the end. He says, just as it was back then, so it will be at the end. People will be laughing and scoffing at what God said is going to happen and all that sort of stuff. Okay, good. Reasons I believe in the flood. New Testament writers clearly believe it was a real event. Matthew 24, 38-39. It tells us the reason for it. And if the flood was not a judgment for sin, then how do we believe that God, that when Jesus comes back and there's going to be another judgment for sin? I mean, if the first thing is not even true, then the second one's also probably not even true. I believe that it's presented by the Bible, not as a natural event, and these other flood people try to make it be a natural event. It's clearly miraculous. I mean, the water's created out of nothing, and then it's gotten rid of. My belief in the flood is based on faith in the Bible. I'm going to make that point probably tomorrow night at some point. I like to separate things that I believe because of the evidence from things that I believe because it says so in the Bible. I believe by evidence that the Bible is inspired by God. I believe by evidence that God exists. I believe by evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead. I believe in heaven. I have no evidence for that at all. I believe in heaven because it says it in the Bible. I believe in Adam and Eve because it says so in the Bible. And then maybe 5% because of some evidence. I believe in the flood about 80% because it's in the Bible. And about 20% because of the evidence. And I think we need to stop acting as if something we believe by faith, that we believe it by evidence, when we don't have a whole lot of evidence for it. So I think we as Christians need to ask ourselves why we believe some things. And a lot of things we believe because the Bible's inspired, and that's why we believe it. And I don't apologize for that at all. Is that sort of circular reasoning? Right, yeah. It is. It's circular reasoning that works. And so if circular reasoning works, then I'm just going to stick with it. All right? So I assume that when I see an apparent contradiction, it's probably because they don't understand the Bible. And every time I do that, it turns out, oh, that was right. Oh, okay, then at some point, like, for example, I believe that my wife is faithful to me, and I've got plenty of evidence. And if somebody presented evidence of the contrary, I'd say, yeah, whatever. You know? Sometimes presuppositions are a good idea. In fact, we can't live without presuppositions. All right, and so that's what I apply to the to that. Okay, Melchizedek. Why is Melchizedek in there? I have no. Why did I do that? Oh, this is the wrong outline. Oh, I got the wrong outline here. That's okay. I'll switch to the other outline. But let's do this just for fun, since we're here. I have to go back though. Sorry about that. It'll take me just a few seconds to get the correct outline. All right, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little thing on archaeology in the Old Testament just for fun. All right, got it? All right. Yeah. Yeah, I did a thing for the Rocky Mountain School of Ministry. All right, so what about archaeology and Genesis? Okay. Now, where in the biblical timeline, starting with even the Tower of Babel up to, I don't know, Jesus' time, where in the biblical timeline should you start to see actual physical evidence you could dig out of the ground that says that thing that I just saw reflects something that's written in the Bible? Where would that happen? No. No.
I want to say Sodom and Gomorrah.
No.
Earlier or later?
No. The answer is the reign of David. I mean, what would you find from Abraham?
Yeah, he's like everywhere.
A tent? I mean, how could you ever find an actual archaeological thing that represents Adam and Eve? Forget it. You know what I'm saying? How about the Jews in Egypt? They were living in abject poverty, in hovels. They probably didn't even have writing or anything. And even during the conquest, you might find evidence of destruction by the Jews, but not of anything the Jews built. And even during the period of the judges, it's really not until you reach David, or even maybe arguably son Solomon, that you could even hope to actually go somewhere and dig something up and say, this thing that I just saw, that thing right here that I'm holding, that thing is something that's mentioned in the Bible. So in order to show the historical and archaeological accuracy of the book of Genesis, you have to look for indirect evidence. In other words, we're not going to dig up Abraham's house. All right, and to expect that, and people say there is no archaeological evidence for the Jews in Egypt or for the Exodus. All right, and you know what? It's true, and of course there isn't. And why are you going out there looking for something you're never going to find anyway? That's a waste of time. All right, but I would say that actually, if you look in the Near East, in roughly 2000 to 1800 BC, you find some stuff. You kind of go, well, that's really interesting. For example, let's see here. If you read in Genesis, there are two cities mentioned. One is Ur. The other one is Haran. And if you read, Ur is this vast city. In fact, I don't have the ziggurat in Ur, but Ur was... We know where it was. It's been dug up. And it was probably the largest city in Mesopotamia, maybe even in the world, in around 2000 BC. And then there's the city of Haran, which has been dug up. And it's in the region of Syria that's kind of between Mesopotamia and Palestine. It was sort of like an outpost, if you will. And the city of Haran was destroyed around 1600 BC and never rebuilt. And yet, there are the ruins of Haran. Now, imagine what the atheists say, which is, Genesis, just a myth. It's just a bunch of stories. Come on, Abraham, come on. Moses. That's not even Genesis. come on. No, nobody believes those stories are true. They're just myths. Okay, well then, fine. So let's say Genesis was written in 600 B.C., when was the last time Haran had existed? Haran had not existed for 600 years. Another thing to note is these are the Ebla tablets. They're from roughly 2100 to 1800 BC. It's a city actually in the same area pretty much as Haran. They found something like 6,000 tablets. Some of the names mentioned in the Ebla tablets are Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai. All right? Okay, now do you see Jonathan there, or Abigail, or Jennifer, or Jose? In other words, these were common names, where? In Mesopotamia. When? Around 1800 BC. All right? So again, the historical cultural context of Genesis is not in Moses' time, 1400 BC, I'm not making this up. These are actual names that are used by actual people in Mesopotamia around 1900, 2000 BC. So if you said, yeah, my friend, over in my school, Gertrude, you go, Gertrude? Isn't Gertrude? Come on, that's 100 years ago. So there's some evidence there. Okay, what about this, you know, in Genesis, the five-league city, the thing with Chedorlaomer, and, you know, and Lot ends up caught up in this fight between the League of Five Cities and Lot, and they go fight against Elam and Chedorlaomer, and, you know, and then if, I don't know if you've ever been around the Dead Sea, but it is the most, the idea of people living, what's interesting is in Genesis, Abraham says to Lot, go down by the Dead Sea. That's where the good farming land is. And I'll take the kind of, you know, that's some good stuff up here in the Judean hills. And if you were to go to the Middle East, there you go. That's whacked out, man. Okay, well, guess what? Within the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, a few archaeologists said, you know, let's go check. And what they found out is that around 2100 BC, it's not like this area was this lush thing. It's more like actually kind of like the Central Valley. We get 7 inches of rain this year, you know, here. It probably been less than that. But what they had was a number of wadis. A wadi is the wadis are still there, and they have water in them about as often as the Kern River does now, you know, which you're not a, sorry, Central Valley person, but I mean, so every once in a while, maybe twice a year, water runs down there. But back then, the evidence is they were streams that ran all year long. And they had intensive irrigation. And guess how many cities they've discovered?
Five.
Five. Yeah. Five. The largest of them is in the north, Bab Adra, which almost certainly is Sodom. Okay, and the location of Sodom and Gomorrah and Zeboiim and Farpar, those are, you know, we're not absolutely sure. And all of these cities were destroyed somewhere around 2100 BC by fire and never ever resettled. In fact, the entire area was abandoned. No more evidence of irrigation or farming, just abandoned. Okay, that's sort of cool. There's ruins there. Oh, yeah, and then there's Atusha. Another thing mentioned in Genesis is the Hittites. Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Girgashites, Gershonites, all those otherites. And again, you know, the skeptics of the Bible say, whatever. You know, they must have just said, oh, let's call them Hittites and Jebusites.
Yeah.
In fact, as late as the late 19th century, the critics of Christianity literally laughed. Even at the very existence of Nineveh, never mind the Hittites. Okay, but then in 1906, Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha, which is the capital of a large empire that covered most of Asia Minor, Turkey today, and large parts of Syria. In fact, there were three great powers, Egypt, Hittites, and the ancient Babylonians. So I guess I believe in the Hittites. They're mentioned, I don't know, like 27 times in Genesis. There's the Hittite Empire. It's a pretty sizable empire, 1300 BC. And Uriah was a Hittite, right? It's a little bit later. All right, there's the Gate of Hattusha. In fact, you can actually study the Hittite language in certain universities. Now, for some reason, I don't know what happened, but I picked the wrong PowerPoint. That partially explains why I said, remember, 19 out of 62 slides. That's all right, so sorry about that. I have to get out of this PowerPoint. I have to go to a different one. It might take me a few seconds, and besides, our class is going to end fairly soon anyway. I don't have much time to go, but I do need to find the other one. All right, so Genesis for LASMM, or how about Genesis 2017? I'll go Genesis 2017. That's the one I was supposed to be going over. Okay, great. So let's get to that, because my other notes skipped Genesis 3 and 4 and all. That's kind of important to cover. Okay, so sorry about that. Slideshow from current slide. Oh, it's showing there but not here. What's up with that? Okay. That's bizarre. Okay, there we go. All right, so let's keep going. What time is it? I need to end in about 10 minutes, so I won't be going much longer. It's okay, great. All very good. Seventh day, a young earth theory. Great. All, very good. Ah, here we go. Now let's get into Genesis 2. So Genesis 1, introduction to God. Genesis 2, introduction to human beings, right?
Yeah.
All right. So what about human beings? By the way, there are two creation accounts, which is a little bit confusing. There's the creation account in Genesis 2, which is talks about the creation of human beings and the creation of the garden and farming and all that. I'm going to skip all that stuff because we don't have time for that. Okay. Okay, great. The story of Adam and Eve is the story of us. We are Adam and Eve. Right? So the story is so metaphorical, it's crazy. Yet it's still true. We too were born innocent. We too had everything at our fingertips. We too were given a choice. We too sinned and rebelled. We too lost our innocence and were cast out of the presence of God. So Genesis 2, 4 through 25 is a recounting of creation, but the entire account in Genesis 2, 4 through 25 is also contained. It's basically, it's part of the sixth day of creation. So it's a recounting, but from another perspective. I'm not going to get into that. So we're created in God's image. We're given dominion over the earth. Okay, we're created to know God and to be known by Him. We're created for relationships. We're created with free will. That's the story there. We're created to know God, Genesis 2:18, Genesis 2:23-24, 5. Created, and God was walking in the garden. Was He literally walking? Okay, I don't know. Was He literally, or is it, you know, is that a metaphorical thing going on there? All right, and we're given free will. Genesis 2:9, we're given the choice to either, He said, you know, do not eat of the fruit of that tree, otherwise you will die. Adam and Eve are us. Another thing about Genesis 2, 4 through 25, it's a picture of heaven. The imagery of Ezekiel 47, 1 through 12, which is an amazing passage. If you, the water is flowing from the temple and it's ankle deep, knee deep, hip deep, and then it's just filling the Dead Sea and bringing life to it. Revelation 2, 22, 1 through 5. The imagery of these final accounts of the state of human beings are all taken from the garden, from Genesis. Now there's two trees, the tree of life, a tree which imparts life, which, by the way, is still there. Genesis 22, 2, still there. It's kind of, we're back in the garden. And the tree of life is, we're back there eating from the tree of life. That's great. Were Adam and Eve, were they immortal? Did they lose immortality when they ate that fruit? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think these bodies were ever intended to be our final bodies. I read 1 Corinthians 15, and God says, I've got a different body in mind for you. It's an immortal body. So I personally do not believe, this is just my opinion, I personally don't believe that Adam and Eve were created immortal. That's just my opinion. The death they inherited upon eating the fruit was spiritual death and separation. Okay? The tree of knowledge of good and evil. What is this knowledge? It's the knowledge of things that we really were better off not knowing about. When they ate from that fruit, they learned about stuff that really wasn't healthy for them. All right? It made them more like God, though. That Satan told them, if you know these things, you'll be more like God. Right? Genesis 3:5. He said, if you eat these things, you're going to be more like God. And that's what Satan does, half-truths. They became more like God and more unlike God at the same time. Genesis 3:5, he says, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Right? Basically, the sin of Adam and Eve was this. What God gave them, they said, it's not enough. We want more. What God has for us is not sufficient. Isn't that the basic question for all of us as disciples? Is what God has for you enough for you, or do you want more? If you want more, God says, you can have it. But unfortunately, the things that I wanted to give you, I'm going to have to take some of those away. And that's kind of what's going on there. Okay, got it? All right. So if we eat of that tree, we will die. Notice in Genesis 11:4, they want to make a name for themselves. They want to make themselves great. The knowledge that we inherited, and you know the knowledge that we inherited, which I believe in a sense we do inherit that knowledge. We do not inherit the sin of Adam, but I do believe we inherit the knowledge that Adam gained. So we fell in that sense, not in the Calvinistic sense that we genetically inherit the consequences. The soul of sin is the ones who will die. That's Ezekiel 18. But I do believe that there's a sense in which we are born with this knowledge of things that God kind of wishes we didn't know about. I get that sense, even children. So they want to make names of themselves. That we said, if we eat of this tree, we will die, okay? Romans 5:12 said sin came into the world and death through sin. Is that physical death or spiritual death? That's spiritual death. Okay? Could it be both? I don't know. Maybe. I'm not going to debate. I don't care about that. I do care about this, though, that it, the result was spiritual death and separation. Kicked out of the garden, no longer able to eat from the tree of life. Again, would the tree of life have made them immortal? I don't know. My opinion, no, but I don't care about that. Okay, and then Genesis 2:20-25, God creates a helper. Adam, you know, God says you can, we've got all these animals, and Adam's going through all the animals. He's like, that's cool, but, you know, I'm just feeling, I don't know, dogs and cats, they're cool, but, you know, I need something else. So God is formed from Adam's rib. All right, in other words, equal. Right? The symbolism of that is equality. Adam gets pretty fired up about that, naked and unashamed, that's cool stuff. All right. Then Genesis 3-11, and we're going to stop there. We got through Genesis 2. That's pretty good. We only have 48 chapters to go. All right. And so we will definitely finish part A in Genesis tomorrow, but and hopefully we'll start on part B. We'll start on Abraham. But anyway, so Genesis 2, the fall of Adam and Eve. Genesis 3, Cain kills Abel. Genesis 6-9, the flood. And then the Tower of Babel. That ends the first part of Genesis. So we're seeing the progressive degradation of human beings. And then God's going to solve the problem. All right. God says to Adam and Eve, there's just one thing you can't have. All right, we'll get into that later. Okay, any questions as we end early? We're ending quite a bit early, actually. Any questions?
Yes. So you don't believe that there was, that the physical death was inherited by sin? So do you think there were carnivores in the garden, like lions?
Well, of course there were.
Lions, so there was death in that.
Yeah, you see, yeah, so much of what people believe about Genesis comes not from the Bible, but from Calvinism.
Yeah.
Calvinism explains so much.
Yeah.
All right, so Calvinism said, you know, there's this belief in you know, total depravity, but that's not true. All right, and so, yeah. So, and anyway, Calvinists have their sort of proof text for some of these things, but they're not very good proof text to me. Now, so some people say it didn't rain before. You know, come on. By the way, there's fossil rain. There's actual fossil raindrops from tens of millions of years old. All right. Now, it's not like there was never a rainbow. But come on, give me a break. There was rainbows. Basically, God's saying, you know, whenever you see a rainbow from now on.
Now that's my symbol.
Right, right.
Remember that.
Right, exactly. And so the idea that what were lions eating? Like apples or something like that?
Back up.
The teeth of lions is really good at eating only one thing, which is meat. And anyway, there's an assumption there that natural things are somehow not even good. You know, that you know, there's this idea that a carnivore is somehow bad. What's bad about an animal eating another animal? I mean,
well, it's the loss of life.
Anyway, there's nothing bad about that. Any other questions? Yeah.
What do you do with texts like objects of wrath and predestination and also God causing pain and suffering?
Yeah.
And, you know, suggestion that, well, I know in Job it says does not bad come from God as well, good and bad.
Okay, now can you ask, please, one question at a time? That was about four questions.
Well,
I want to answer all your questions, but please give me one question first, and then...
Well,
there are texts that could be interpreted that way, but they're being incorrectly interpreted. God allows evil.
Yeah.
He even gives permission to Satan to do evil because he gives us free will. He gives you permission to look at pornography. In fact, in Romans 1, he says he gives them over to those things. Basically, he says, if you want, you know, like the Jews, they said, give us meat. He said, okay, I'll give you meat. It's going to come up to your neck and you're going to be... swimming in rotten pheasant meat.
Yeah.
God does that because he loves us. Does that mean God's wrath is not real? God's wrath is, man, is as real as could be.
But it's not evil.
No, it's not evil. Justice is good.
So what you're saying is evil does not come from God.
Right. Evil exists because of rebellion against God. As Augustine said, everything God created is good, but human beings corrupt. They take something which is good and they use it for evil purposes.
I struggle with that.
Okay.
Like, logically, it doesn't make sense.
Okay.
Because if God created everything, he must have created evil.
Okay.
Well,
for example, let me give you an example. I have children. And let's say my child goes out and robs a store. Am I responsible for that?
Partially. Let
other people don't interject on every single thing. Okay, let people sit and think.
Legally, no.
Morally.
Depends.
Okay.
Depends on if you taught your child how to rob.
Oh, I'm responsible for what I did. Right. I'm responsible for what I did. Yeah, exactly. I'm responsible for what I did, but not for what they did, because human beings understand the idea of justice and they understand the idea of free will. Even those who deny the existence of free will, they still know that it's real and they live according to that. Everything they do says they believe it, even though they say they don't. And everything that they do, atheists do, says they believe in justice, even though they say they don't believe in that. So God's holiness is real. His justice is real. But the bottom line is this. You know, you could blame me for what my kids did because if it weren't for my wife and I, they wouldn't exist. So ultimately God is responsible. Ultimately. Because God created a world in which evil could exist. And if God hadn't created that world, that evil would not have happened. So sure. Okay. But on Judgment Day, are you going to say, God, it's your fault that I did that? No. So those are kind of two different things. Right. So what you're saying is true, but it's not the whole story.
Right.
Justice, you know, and God's justice is not the same as our justice. God's justice is the parable of the workers in the field.
Yep.
God's justice is Ezekiel 18, which is not our justice. So our version of justice and God's version of justice are very much different. They fit the same broad categories, but they're very different. Now, but you had about four questions, and I didn't answer all the questions. Oh, okay, yeah, sorry.
Objects of wrath and predestination.
Good. So I taught a class on predestination several years ago in San Diego. Okay, got it? Why they asked me to teach a class of predestination, this was like 12 years ago, and it's like, anyway, so, and it was at a big conference of the Southwest conference, and we used to have these things. They haven't had them for like 10, 12 years, but we used to have them all the time. So everybody would come to this conference, and most of the conferences were on evangelism and marriage and all that sort of stuff. They asked me to do a class on predestination. I thought, oh, that's okay, sure, that's great. I'm a teacher. I love it. Anyway, they gave me the smallest classroom because obviously nobody's going to go to it. But anyway, not only was it filled, there were people standing along the side and sitting on the floor, and there were people outside the door, and then I don't know how many people were sent away because no one was out there. So here's how I started the class. I said, how many here believe in predestination? Guess how many people raised their hand? No, one.
You.
Me.
Yeah.
If you read Romans 8 and 9, if you don't come away from that believing in predestination, what did you read? But the thing is, biblical predestination is not Calvinism. The difference between biblical predestination and Calvinism is that Calvinism is the difference between night and day. Because Calvinism said God created some people for salvation and some people for destruction. God created the elect and the reprobate. And we are born totally depraved and absolutely incapable of responding to God in any way whatsoever. That's not what Romans 8 and 9 teaches at all. Basically, God's predestination is that everybody should know him. And does God ever intervene in history and say, I'm sorry, your free will is canceled right here? Sure, he does that with Judas. Why was that? So that we could be saved. He did that with Pharaoh. Why was that? So we could be saved. I believe every time God intervenes in history, which he does very, very rarely, most of them are recorded in the Bible. If you read the Bible, it almost seems like God is doing it all the time. But even in Israel's history, he very rarely intervened. Very rarely. But every time God intervenes, it's so that he could save us. So the greatest times of intervention of God in the Bible are, for example, in freeing the people of Israel from Egypt. And that is a foreshadow and a prefigure of incredible complexity of exactly what God did in Jesus. We too were in Egypt. We too were freed by the blood of a lamb being put on a wooden crossbeam. We too passed through the Red Sea. We were baptized into Christ as they were baptized into Moses. I mean, almost every single detail of that entire story is an exact perfect picture of what God did in Jesus. So does God ever intervene? Yeah. Now, did he sort of jerk Pharaoh around? Sure. He's God. If he wants to, he says in Romans 9, if you don't like that, you know, good luck winning that debate with God. But his point is not that God is trying to hurt people. He says, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. The point is not that he hated Esau. He loved Esau, but he chose Jacob. That's Malachi 1:1. That's Romans 9:12. God's predestination is our salvation. That's what he's saying. Those he foreknew, he predestined, called, justified, and glorified. All right? But he predestined all of us for salvation. Did he call all of us? No, no. Some people never get called. Isn't that a shame? Whose fault is that? That's our fault. All of those who are called, are all those justified? No. A lot of people say, no, thank you, God. Are all those who are justified glorified? That's once saved, always saved. No, none. That's the false interpretation of Romans 8. The correct interpretation is those God foreknew, he predestined. Jesus said, in my Father's house, there are many rooms. If it weren't so, I wouldn't have told you. So, yeah, I believe in predestination. I believe in God intervening. I also believe God allows evil to happen. And God is even in his omnipotence able to use evil for good. He will do that. That's not his preferred method, but he will. Yeah. All right, next question. Yeah. Yeah.
So, in this idea of, like, you know, in suffering and stuff like that, like, I hear your, and I think it explains a lot of human evils that occur in this world, right? But I think of, like, unfair circumstances that involve suffering. Like,
yeah.
You know, naturally, like, whether it be natural disasters,
sure.
Sickness, you know, and stuff like that causes a lot of
right.
suffering. How do you reconcile that with
God? Right, that's a whole other lecture. That's a about an hour and a half lecture I could give. So let me give you the short version. See, there's two problems, and they're connected, but they're definitely not the same problem. Problem number one is the problem of evil, and problem number two is the problem of suffering. They're connected because the cause of most suffering is evil and sin, but not all of it. So we got there was an earthquake in Afghanistan yesterday. It's going to kill over 1,000 people. Was that caused by sin? No, it was caused by plate tectonics. All right, so what about plate tectonics? All right, plate tectonics, you know, basically God created this earth, and if the earth was static, then we would have no atmosphere, and the surface would be sterile. So God created plate tectonics, which is a massive recycling system, which recycles the minerals. Awesome, thank you very much. I'd rather farm near a volcano, although be careful farming near a volcano, because there's problems there. If it weren't for plate tectonics, we would have no atmosphere, and the Earth would be sterile. If you want to live on a planet with no plate tectonics, go to Mars, but there's a problem there, no atmosphere and pretty sterile, okay? And now, you could say, well, then why didn't God create a better world where you don't have earthquakes? If you could create a better universe than the one God made, I'd happily bow to your better creation. But I say thank you, God, for plate tectonics. I say thank you, God, for weather as well. There are hurricanes and tornadoes. But here's the problem. See, God made a round earth. Why is it round? Because of gravity. Again, if you could create planets by another natural set of laws other than the one we have, like a cylindrical planet would be better. I'll admit that. Because if the planet was cylindrical, then you could get the light, the energy, and it would be distributed much more equally. But again, if you could create a universe with cylindrical planets, help me out with the equations. If physicists would tell you that doesn't make sense. So anyway, the Earth is round, and the whole idea that God gives energy to this round object from this other object over there, let's talk about that. That amazing creation, the idea of fusion and creating energy, and it lasts for billions. I mean, wow. But then the Earth is round, so near the equator it would be like 187 degrees. Near the poles it would be minus 300 degrees, and there would be this narrow, narrow strip where life could actually exist. But the problem is it would move over time. So God created weather, which very efficiently distributes that energy. All right. Now, in the process of distributing it, occasionally there are situations where the energy is moving a little bit too fast. So I say probably, you know, living near a fault zone is a pretty bad idea. And building a five-story house with bad construction, it's a pretty bad. You know, I don't mean to laugh about that. So, yeah. And besides, suffering is not the problem. Death is not the problem. Sin and separation is the problem. From God's perspective, the fact that we die is that's not a problem. That's a problem for us, and God understands that. God is a compassionate God. And he feels for us as we experience this suffering of death. But we need to understand that death is not the problem. Sin is the problem. And suffering, I mean, pain. If it were not for pain, everybody in this room would be dead. I mean, there's this very, very rare, I have no idea, 1 in 10 million where people literally cannot feel pain and they live every moment in danger of death. Because, first of all, if it weren't for pain, I would have died of overeating. My stomach would have burst, my you know, et cetera. So pain is essential. Emotional pain is essential. And, you know, emotional pain is evidence that there's something going on that you need to do about that. And one of the, I mean, gravity is a natural law. There's another natural law that says if you sin, you produce suffering. Sin brings suffering into the world. That's Exodus 20, verse 4. God says, I will bring punishment to the third and fourth generation of those who, you know, the Ten Commandments, all that stuff. Really? I thought Ezekiel 17, 4 says only the one who sins is the one who will die. But that's talking about the spiritual consequences. Ezekiel is the eternal spiritual consequences. Exodus 20 is the physical consequences in this life. So the cause of most suffering is sin and rebellion, but definitely not all. Sin and rebellion did not cause AIDS. And I know some Christians say that. Those people should shut up and stop. That is garbage. Who are you to say that? that God created AIDS to judge homosexuals. Give me a break. All right, so now, are there kinds of suffering that are problematic? Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. A baby is born with a birth defect and lives for a few weeks, suffers intensely, her parents suffer intensely, and then they die. It's like, why would God allow that? You know, that's kind of a hard one. Yeah. But I do know this, that evolution is a good thing, and evolution occurs because of mutations, and that allows things to adapt and change over time. You know, and the fact is, in fact, most mutations produce spontaneous abortions. Women, come on.
Miscarriages.
Yeah. But every once in a while, the woman doesn't have a miscarriage, and that is tragic. God understands that. Anyway. So, the cause of evil is rebellion. The cause of suffering, there's two categories. The majority of suffering is because of rebellion and stubbornness and rejection. And God gave us this principle, this law, that if you rebel against me, this will bring suffering into the world. That's my way of telling you that is. Besides, it's both. He told us not to do it because it would cause suffering. But then there are natural causes, as you seem to understand even in your question. And again, if you could make a better universe, and God never intended us to be eternal, that these bodies are temporary, and that's a good thing. Now, if you're an atheist and you're dead like Rover dead all over, I could see why that would be a problem for you. But the atheist is wrong. Okay. Great. Well, that went too long. And we need to stop because Jan's going to make some dinner. Now, what are we doing after that? We're doing the jumping?
Bowling.
All right. Why don't you take over? Yep. Come up here. I'm done. So can you talk to your people here and decide what you guys are doing tonight? Great.